Number six, we spent last time, did we not, talking about socialism. I feel like it's so important. You know, apologetics organization, we're focusing on evolution, creation, dinosaurs, existence of God, inspiration of the Bible, deity of Christ. But I also feel like the culture war that's raging, when it is hostile to Christianity, to Christian principles and morality, that we ought to give some response to that. And so I've spent some time studying socialism, and I'm convinced that it is clearly anti-biblical. It's not simply one possible biblical or a political or economic ideology. It is a philosophy, a perspective that clashes with Bible principles. All right, here's kind of closure on the socialism thing, quibbles that I've heard brought up. Well, you know, the early church practiced socialism. Read those early chapters of Acts, where they had all things in common and blah, blah, blah. And I've written somewhat extensively on this. I believe it's in the book. That's simply not true. They did not practice Christian socialism, and nor was there any prototype being given even in that early practice for the church for all time and for all places. And number two, when Jesus fed multitudes, gave them free food, wasn't that socialism? No, remember when he did that, it was performing miracles. And the Bible is clear about the singular purpose of miracle. There may be side benefits. If he heals somebody, oh, well, you get healed. But that's not why he did it. Mark 16:20, Hebrews 2, and other passages tell us the purpose of miracles is to confirm the oral word that's being given by a human emissary. So it verified Jesus' divine identity, his claims to deity, and it backed the apostles and their preaching and showed that their preaching was, in fact, from God. So he didn't set up a system in the early church by which thousands of people could be fed with a few loaves and fishes. You know, if anybody could have done that, and that was the appropriate thing to do, that would have been the place to do it. But, of course, it's not there. Well, what about, what capitalism leads to is greed and blah, blah, blah. And look at the temple, those guys in the temple selling stuff. Well, whatever was wrong about that was wrong, not because it was capitalism. Capitalism is just a person saying, okay, I'm going to try to make a living for myself, so I'm going to go buy a laundromat and I'm going to work from daylight or dawn to the time the sun goes down, work my head off and try to make enough money to send my kids to school. There's nothing evil about that. That's capitalism. Capitalism can, a person can be greedy, but come on, look at the socialist countries of the world. What condition are their leaders that put their thumb on all their people? They're greedy people at the top. Well, that's endemic to humans, not to this particular economic approach. No, it's clear when you go to the Bible and see instance after instance after instance of parables and the like where God approves of the principles taking place. Capitalism is what is approved by God. Now let's move to some insight from God's word in the Old Testament. Remember, my rationale for using the law of Moses is because it's the one and only civil law code in human history authored by God himself. So it's perfect for that purpose. The law of Moses was never intended to provide ultimate atonement, and hence Paul in Romans will say things that make it sound like he's being negative about the law, but he's not. The law was authored by God. Remember Romans 7:12, the law is holy, just, and good. Came from the mind of God. But it was never intended to provide ultimate atonement. That was for Jesus to do. But as far as the value of the law of Moses for getting insight into the mind of God about proper civil behavior and how people treat each other and so forth, it's there. When Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, he was quoting the Old Testament. We said, love your neighbors yourself. That's Leviticus 19. So God's thinking is there. Well, how was that set up under the law of Moses? How did the Israelites, here's a country, a nation, how did they handle taxation and the like? Did they have an IRS? No, you know they didn't. Well, did the Israelites pay taxes? Does God authorize people to pay taxes? Yeah, he does. And you remember what that was? We would call it a flat tax. 10% for everybody. How do we handle that in our country? The more you make, the higher percentage you pay. That didn't come from God. Look at Leviticus 27, Deuteronomy 14, a host of other passages. Generally speaking, a tenth came from your produce, your animals, you know, not so much currency. I suppose they didn't, they had currency, they used shekels and so forth, but you were really taxed for your increase each year. Now, what was that used for? Well, we need a welfare system by which we fund a lot of our fellow countrymen. The Bible does not teach that. Well, what about the poor, though? Not the government's job. I'm telling you, that's the Bible view of this thing. It was actually used basically as a salary for the preachers. Think about that. Remember, all the tribal groups had tribal lands. Tribal Levi did not. They were allowed just so much land just around the outskirts of the cities that were designated by God. Otherwise, they had no income. They were to devote themselves to the things of God and do all the stuff associated with the temple and everything. Well, how are they to be paid? Taxation. That's simple. So people were to take tithes to the tabernacle. You know, so far as I could tell, there was no organization, no agency that went around and knocked on your door and said, give us your money, we're going to take it and give it to the Levites. It was up to each Israelite to do that, to do what God told them to do. Isn't that interesting? It's not the purpose of the federal government to provide welfare. Well, then how does God want us to care for the poor? The Bible is filled with concern about the poor, is it not? But I have been absolutely astounded at what the Bible says on this subject that is so contrary to what has become the norm in American civilization. The so-called war on poverty, do you remember who launched it in the 1960s? It assumed a definition of poverty that is in direct conflict with the definition given by God. I want to give you that definition tonight, but first, let me just show you what the poor have actually been in human history, as opposed to what we have come to think of people as poor. Charles Dickens, you remember in the mid-1800s, depicted poverty in England. And so when you look at his books and look at some of the movies that are based upon those books, you get more of an idea. You know, like these kids in this home for children, they're just hoping to get enough food to fill their stomach. Now, that's poverty. If you haven't seen Oliver with an exclamation mark, that old movie, that's a pretty good movie, back in the 60s, I think. A musical, but very well done. Prince and the Pauper, does that fellow look poor? He does. I mean, you can tell immediately, oh, he's poor. These were children during wartime, and I just kind of went through, found a lot of old pictures from World War II, like the Allied bombing raid over Europe that displaced a lot of people, and then, of course, the Great Depression. Probably looking at back over our 200-plus years history, the poorest period would be during the Great Depression, the 1930s. Okay, so what was that like for people? Well, here's some observations. Dorothea Lange, by the way, you can go online to the government website and get a lot of her pictures that were taken back at that time. Pretty fascinating. Destitute pea pickers in California. Here's a 32-year-old mother. She had seven children. Here are children of cotton field workers from Sweetwater, Oklahoma, but here they're in Pinal County, Arizona, because, and notice what the government was trying to do. You know, I think our government, Roosevelt and them, were trying to deal with the situation. And I don't know that the solutions they oftentimes came up with were appropriate, but their basic attitude was, we need to provide jobs, not send them a check in the mail each month. And so that's what we find when we go back and look at this situation. Notice they have shoes on. The little girl doesn't, but you know, most Americans outside of the cities didn't wear shoes in the summer. It doesn't mean they were poor. Look at this picture here. A mother and her children, and look at what's on the left there. Here's a family again. Notice clothing, barefoot. But I would not describe their clothing necessarily as rags, maybe a little tattered, a few holes here and there. Some people, especially when they're migrating to the West, would set up tents and stuff. I went to West Virginia a few years ago, and I showed these pictures, and a fellow came up to me afterwards and said, "Those people weren't poor. Do you not realize that that cook stove and that cream separator," here was his terminology, "that stuff was uptown at the time. That was the latest advancements in those things. These people had in their homes the latest appliances." Go outside of the United States and you see people cooking their food outdoors and creating little makeshift ovens. Typical for most of the world, for most of history. So what you find during the Great Depression are people looking for jobs. Remember this, look at this statement here. You know, what are these kids asking for? "Will you feed us? Will you give us something? We want a job. My dad needs a job." What a different attitude. All these men, I assume this is probably like New York City. Look at, they're in nice clothing. It's cold. See the snow on the ground. They're standing in line at a soup kitchen, not provided by the government. What's wrong with these men? There's no work to be had. They wanted work. They wanted to work for a living. See, today, I mean right now, we're having trouble getting people to work, aren't we? You know, Deb and I went to Backyard Burger, shut down. And I hear it's because I can't get anybody to work. Now, you want to see what real poverty is? That's the worst, so far as I can tell, in America. You may go up some mountain way back in West Virginia somewhere where people are just completely isolated. They don't care to be a part of the rest of society. That might be more destitute, but that's their choice. This is in Indonesia, Muslim country. This is in Uganda. You seen any children dressed like this in this country? People that are deformed and have various physical defects. That's pretty much taken care of in our country now. This fellow here is digging for water for his wife and baby. This is very typical of world poverty. Here's a sacred cow in India, and the kids are in a garbage dump scrounging for food. See the state of their clothing and the meager food that's available to them. And then it gets worse, of course. These are not pleasant images, but it's a fact that there's this kind of hunger in the world. You and I have been told, that's right here in our country. We got hungry children. Really, like this? I know some kids that go without a meal because their parents go get drunk and spend the money, and the kids are kind of left to fend for themselves. Let me show you poverty in America. Nice shoes, nice sleeping bag, nice coat, cigarette, of course. Even the cup used to panhandle money. It's a nice cup. Here, a mother and her two kids. Look at these kids over real close. Well-groomed, well-fed, taken care of. That's not the poverty of the world. By the way, what are you teaching your children, having them hold up the signs and buy into this thinking? Look at the clothing this fellow's wearing. Wearing nice clothes, nice warm bedding, groomed hair, well-fed physique, sitting around collecting handouts. They can afford tattoos. You know, there was a political decision made by a party back a few years ago to release all of the people in insane asylums and places like that and put them on the street. They thought somehow they were being mistreated. And so there are a number of those people that are on the street. Well, I believe we're blinded by our affluence. The fact of the matter is the vast majority of the poor of the world have nothing like what all of us have. And I have all the stats on this too. And by the way, most Americans didn't enjoy the level that we enjoy for most of American history. Look at this statement. Most Americans live better than the richest men of history. Do you believe that? I don't know. There have been some pretty rich people, like Solomon. The Bible tells us that he made big bucks. 1 Kings 9, look at all that the Bible says that he acquired. Ecclesiastes, drinking vessels in his palace were gold. 1 Kings 10, you know, he has this incredible throne with six steps. On each side of the throne, it's overlaid with pure gold. It's ivory, but it's overlaid with pure gold. Two lions stood at the armrest, and then on each of the six steps, you got two more lions going all the way down. Every 3 years, merchant ships bring in gold, silver, ivory. Here's a summary statement in 1 Kings 10. He surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. Here is Marcus Crassus, who was at the time of Julius Caesar, part of the first Roman triumvirate. They said he amassed a fortune between $200 million and $20 billion. Here's the richest man that the internet says lived. His name was Mansa Musa I, a Muslim back in the 13th and 14th centuries. He went on a Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca, took 60,000 in his retinue, along with some 12,000 slaves. And what wasn't covered in gold was transporting gold. Filthy rich. William the Conqueror, remember, invaded England from Normandy across the channel, reigned for more than 20 years, built equivalent a fortune of $229.5 billion. China, here's a listing of one of the Manchu officials of the Xing Dynasty. And wealth, I mean, just unbelievable wealth. But I'm telling you, you and I are richer than they are. You say, but what are you talking about? I don't have a room that's piled up with gold. Okay, but what could they do with that gold? Could they go buy a refrigerator and cool their drinks in it? Absolutely not. They had to have slaves go find ice somewhere 50 miles away and try to get it there before it melted. Solomon didn't have a refrigerator. None of those people owned an automobile, let alone an airplane. They didn't have cell phones. They didn't have the communication that we have. You and I live more comfortable, wealthier. We live like kings, I'm telling you. That exceeds all of the wealthy people of the world. You know, just indoor plumbing, we take that for such granted. My parents lived out on the farm in Missouri and Oklahoma, and they had to go outside of the house to go to the restroom. There may be a few people still around that experienced that, but not many. If you told your children they need to start doing that, what would they do and say? Showers are not even that old. I mean, you could put a bucket up there and poke holes in it, pour water in it, and stand under it. That's about as good as it got. Automobiles, buses, bicycles, motorcycles. But look at the government's assessment of the poor in our country. 99.6% of Americans have a refrigerator in their home, which none of those wealthy people I showed you in history had. And then just work your way down the line. Television, stove, oven, microwave, air conditioner, at least one VCR, and on it goes. How about a coffee maker? No such thing a few hundred years ago. But you have one. You live better than most people have lived in human history. American poverty ain't what it used to be. A new report from the Census Bureau found that 80.9% considered poverty stricken by the government have cell phones, landline phones. Over half of them have computers, televisions, DVRs. Typical poor household is defined by the government. They have a car, an air conditioner, two-color televisions, cable or satellite TV, DVD player, VCR. If they're children, especially boys, the family has a game system like Xbox or PlayStation. In the kitchen, they have a refrigerator, oven, stove, microwave, other household conveniences. including clothes washer, clothes dryer, ceiling fans, cordless phone, coffee maker, the home of the typical poor family, see, notice that, poor, is in such good repair and not overcrowded. In fact, the typical average poor American has more living space in his home than the average European that's not considered poor. You know that if you've done any travel to Europe and beyond. You're amazed at how little everything is. Even the roads. We spread out. We got big roads to drive on. That's America. That's not typically the rest of the world. By their own report, the typical poor family was not hungry, able to obtain medical care. That's what's astounded me about all this talk about government medical care. There's no reason to do that unless you have some ulterior political motive. Why? Because we've been taking care of people medically all along. I've known members of the church that are on hospital boards. They allow so much money every year to be given to indigent people. That's been going on for years and years in America. And churches helped, charitable organizations. Look at this. What's the percentage of the world population that lives on $2.50 a day or less? Half of the world. Half of the world. So we're talking about 3 billion people. How about the percentage that live on less than 10? Now we're up to 80%. Number of children that die each day due to poverty, 22,000. When was the last time you opened the newspaper, listened to the news, or viewed it on television, and they said, okay, we've had 10 more deaths due to starvation, poverty in our country? It's happening all over the world. Not America. Have you ever known anybody in this country in your lifetime that died from starvation? I'm telling you, we don't have a clue. Our kids sure don't. They don't have a clue how good they've got it. By the standards of the entire world for 6,000 years, we are rich. Any way you want to look at it. So, let's go back to our Bibles and determine what is the meaning of the word poor and not allow the world around us to give us the definition. This was a very eye-opening discovery when I studied this. Bible's very specific about it. Three basic necessities that you have to have. Food and covering, which consists of clothes, and then some form of shelter. And notice what Paul said about that in 1 Timothy 6. If you've got that, you need to be content. Oh, Paul, are you saying I need to be content to be poor? He's saying, no. If you have that, you're not poor. Well, I at least need a cell phone. Well, that might be a nice luxury to have, but a lack of it doesn't mean you're poor. I'm going to give you passage after passage after passage that proves this to you. You've seen them all before, but probably didn't think about it in these terms. Wearing rags, according to the Bible, poverty is wearing rags, not knowing where your next meal will come from, and having no roof over your head. So, we have misdefined poor to mean something that other people don't have that we have. Let's start with Job. Here's the reasons why Eliphaz insisted that Job was wicked. You don't provide food and clothing for people. And not anything there about all the other stuff that we think maybe we ought to be given to people. Job 24. Here is Job describing the wicked. I agree with you. You know, a person who doesn't provide food, doesn't provide clothing or shelter, that's wicked. But that's not me, Job said. Show me somebody that's not dressed with the fleece of one of my sheep. Job 31, my morsel. If I didn't give a morsel of food, if I didn't offer clothing, moving it back to Genesis 28 where Jacob made that vow. Look what he says to God. If you'll give me bread to eat, clothing to put on, and a place to stay. That's all I'm asking from you, Lord. Deuteronomy 10. How do you take care of the fatherless, the widow? Food and clothing. Isaiah 32. People that are hungry and thirsty. That's Isaiah 32. Isaiah 41, the poor and the needy seek water. They need something to drink. Ezekiel 18, this is the description of a just man. They've been given, he gives bread to the hungry and covers the naked with clothing. Matthew chapter 6, moving to the New Testament. Don't take any thought what you shall eat, what you shall put on. I heard a person think that that meant it's okay if you overeat and put on a lot of weight, because Jesus said, take no thought what you shall put on. That was supposed to be a little bit humorous. But notice Jesus is talking right down the line, what you eat, drink, and what you put on, your clothes. Matthew 6, all these things, if you'll seek first the kingdom, God will see that you have these things. What's that? Well, an automobile, a cell phone, a really nice house with carpet, blah, blah, blah. See how much God has blessed us beyond, unimaginably beyond what we need or deserve. Because all he actually says, he promises to give us, if we'll seek him first, food and clothes and shelter. Romans 12, if your enemy's hungry, give him food and drink. James 2, if a brother or sister is naked, destitute of daily food. All right, look at the terminology here. So you've got naked and you just say, go be warm. No, you've got to provide clothes. Daily food, well, just be filled. That's talking about the necessity of food. This is what's necessary to demonstrate your faith and to take care of people that are needy, according to the Bible. There's the passages I gave you, and of course there are many others. So the Bible definition of poverty is lacking the three basic necessities for life. Isn't that simple? So unbelievably simple. You know, I've been amazed at how even shelter, you know, if you go to the South Seas, the Pacific South, you know, they got grass huts on a beach. It never gets cold, there's no snow. So there's their covering, their shelter. Simple. God doesn't promise us a fancy home with all the things that we enjoy as Americans. That's not what covering and shelter has been for most of human history. Go up to Alaska and you could have an igloo made out of ice and live there. Anybody starving in America? Do you see naked people with tattered clothing walking around? Anyone unsheltered? We have shelters that are being used. But I guarantee you, when you look into the specific situations, those situations could be fixed if there was more desire on the part of the people that are involved in it. There are exceptions. I believe one of the greatest travesties perpetrated by the federal government on many of our citizens is instilling in their minds, well, I'm poor. I'm poor. Don't you think poor people deserve a break? You're poor? You don't look like you've missed a meal. In fact, you're very overweight. And the clothing you're wearing is very nice. What are we talking about here? Well, you know that wouldn't go over very well. All right, so all of this is in this book. What's our time frame here? I was going to pause there if I can't get any further. Oh, man, we got time. All right, let's go a little further. How does the government define poor? Oh, they're very specific too. They define it subjectively, based on comparison of citizens. Here are the two government agencies that have made these decisions for us over the last several years. Department of Health and Human Services and the U.S. Department of Commerce. Their measure of poverty is poverty threshold, and they set this every year. This is defined as a lack of those goods and services commonly taken for granted by members of mainstream society. Come on, most of us have a car. So if you don't, you're down there in the state of poverty. That's where they're coming from on this. This is right from their websites. This was 2020, last year. A family of four, if they make less than $26,000, they are deemed by the government as poor and therefore capable of receiving the host of welfare program monies that have been created over the past, 50 years? Even though more than a third of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day, and we're saying somebody that makes $26,000 is poor? Relative poverty views poverty as socially defined and dependent upon social context. It's defined as having significantly less income and wealth than other members of society. So relative poverty is not intended to measure poverty, but income inequality. Have you heard that expression? A couple of presidents back used it frequently. We're trying to eradicate income inequality. Here's a very practical illustration. You make $50,000, I make $20,000. That disparity means I'm poor and therefore I ought to be given money from the government in order to lessen that gap. See, that's socialism. It's an attempt to level everybody. And the only way to do that, to bring people up from lower elements, lower income, is to bring the people that are wealthier down. That's literally what socialist countries have done throughout history. Poverty is therefore defined strictly in terms of how much one has compared to others. It therefore fluctuates without you doing anything. Today you might be deemed by the government not poor, and tomorrow you'll be deemed poor, and you haven't done anything, because they're not defining poverty by those who are hungry, those who lack clothing, and those who lack shelter, as God defines it. Starting in the 1980s, relative poverty rates in the U.S. have consistently exceeded those of other wealthy nations. In other words, you go to Europe right now, and you're going to find that they do not consider their people poor who make less than what our poor people make. See, it's an artificial definition that the government created. I'm not challenging the motives of those who did it, but they're wrong, because they're not conforming to God's thinking on this, and therefore they're throwing society into chaos. Defining poverty by income does not take into account a person's decisions. You know, we're going to crank out money to people every month, and we're not going to monitor how they spend it. If they want to go spend it all on drugs, there's not anybody in the government monitoring that, nor should they, because they shouldn't be giving it to them. Freedom means you are allowed in this country, the government's supposed to get as much as it can out of your way in order to live your own life. Make your own choices. If you want to lie on a couch all day and be a couch potato and watch TV, that's fine. That's a free country. But then don't expect the government or somebody to step in and give you food and clothes and drink. Doesn't that make sense? See, this is God's thinking. God expects people to take responsibility for their economic condition. By defining it as a certain level of income rather than in terms of ability to care for oneself, you know, like blindness, or there's any host of things that we would all agree we ought to assist our fellow man with, although I would question whether the government ought to be doing it. God wants his people to do it, the church. But what about our veterans? What they've been through when they come home with body parts and limbs blown off. You think the government bears any responsibility? Do we bear any responsibility that these young fellows and women have gone off and defended us and done things in our name and on our behalf? Do we have any responsibility to them? And yet, you know, you've heard, at least until the last administration, that the Veterans Administration was in horrible shape. Our veterans were being treated horribly. Well, there would be a place for the government to step in. Notice then, once you get this in your mind, we got a lot of people who got a lot of money. We need to take that and give it to people who don't have much money. Once you go down that road, then you're going to talk about redistributive justice. Another expression used over and over. We looked at this last week. Thinking that caring for the poor means that we've got to rectify this income inequality and equalize everybody, bring everybody to the same economic status. You know, that may fly well in some Harvard economics classroom where they pump kids full of that stuff, as all those Ivy League schools have been doing for many years. But it does not bode well in reality. And if you don't think so, just go look at all the socialist countries in the world and determine whether you want to live there. Well, this approach violates several biblical principles. We must not define poor as anyone who has less than me. Why do people get in a situation where they lack money? Think of some of the reasons that are obvious. Then we'll look at some of God's reasons. Mismanagement of money. See, we're all susceptible to that. Your children are, right? You've seen your children mismanage their money. Come back for more. What do you spend your money on? You know, when Deb and I were married, we did not buy cereals that had all that sugar in them, you know. We had to buy like Cheerios and stuff like that, not the really good stuff. See, we were forced in to being frugal based upon our income, which wasn't much, going to school and all that. That's good for us. That's healthy. That's appropriate. What if the government had come in and said, man, we're going to start sending you all this stuff that you don't have? That's not the role of the government. How much you buy, whether you save. See, these are choices that humans make that get them into predicaments. I had a preaching student come to me when I was directing a school of preaching out in Texas, and he said, Dave, is there any way the school can provide me with $60 or $70 for my glasses? My glasses broke. And what would you say to that? Well, I don't know how I somehow had the wherewithal to say, well, you know, you're on support. What are you doing with your money? Have you made any purchases recently? He said, yeah, I did buy a $90 pair of rollerblades. You know, those shoes that had a line of rollers on it that you could roll on sidewalks, skate around. So I said, I can't help you. Was I mean? I mean, you're going to take the Lord's support money that you're being given graciously by a number of Christians that are working hard to provide you with this, and you're going to go buy rollerblades with that money and then ask me to pay for you. I had another fellow that came to me and said, man, my mother's in the hospital. Can the church help? Wait a minute. You're on a stipend from the government. What'd you do with that? Well, I bought Christmas presents for my grandchildren. Well, don't you think that you should have? I'm not going to not buy presents for my grandchildren. He was adamant. Okay? I don't know what to do with that cockeyed thinking. But the solution is sure not to enable people in God's sight with that kind of approach to life. Look at the choice that young people make all the time with education. You know, if you dropped out of school early, if you goofed around in school, didn't pay attention, made bad grades, flunked out, whatever. That's your choice. And you have a right to make that choice in this country. It's a free country. But why would you get upset if you choose to be a preacher and don't make surgeon money? What do you think about that, Dwayne? I'm not jealous of a neurosurgeon. He or she decided to pay the price in order to make the money that they make. And the Bible teaches none of us should be jealous of anybody else just because they make more, have more, or do more than us. That's wicked. We're making our choices, and we ought to live with them. There are occasions where there's job loss. You know, that's happened in our country. And look at all the businesses that have shut down because of this COVID thing. So there are reasons why people are economically deprived. But may I suggest to you that the vast majority of these are due to personal decision, personal choices, and it's not the role of the government to step in and fix it. Then I went to Proverbs. You know, the Proverbs have a bunch to say about the poor. So I started in Proverbs 1, go to 31 and figure out, all right, what clues do we get here from God's mind about what's going on with the poor? Why does this happen? I found 9. And I tried to synthesize these passages and categorize them under 9, maybe more than that. For example, laziness, sloth, inactivity, not working, idleness, too much sleep, indolence, talking. Go into Walmart or whatever and shop these days and is it not the case? It is in Montgomery. A lot of the employees stand around talking. not working. And maybe have their phone out and they're doing this. And you're like, can you tell me if you all have this? No, we don't have that. Back in my day when I worked at Safeway out in Arizona, you'd have been fired like that. Because you were being paid to work, not talk. Or be on, boy, if we'd had cell phones, I'm sure they would have banned all those. Put them in a bucket at the door when you come in. You can't have those while you're working. And believe it or not, you and I would think that's terrible mistreatment. I can't live without that. But we did back then, didn't we? We lived without a cell phone. They're convenient. You're stranded out on a road or something, but generally speaking, we become glued to them, and they're not that important. Number two, the word slackness, not being diligent and attentive to what needs to be done. You know, when you, men, if you mow your grass, you're paying attention to it during these summer rains and noticing as it gets up, I got to do something about that. Now, you're either going to pay somebody to do it or you're going to go out and do it. And you've got to work it into your schedule and you've got to go out there and endure the heat and all of that. But you and I are used to doing all that stuff. Why? Because hopefully our parents taught us responsibility and not being slack, being attentive to the things that need to be done. That's Christian. That's a Christian principle. And it's evaporating in our society. And the solution? Get the government to give people money. That's exacerbating the problem. It is, in fact, destroying our country to think that's the solution. Imagine if we could get back into the schools and teach all the children in all the schools, listen, you need to pay attention here because you're going to have to make a living. You're going to have to be able to function on your own. There was a member of the church in northwest Alabama. What's the name of the little town up there? It's on the way, you know, out, up, and right in that area. And it's one of his members, a lady, teaches in the public school system. And one day she started the class by saying, okay, kids, tell me, what are you going to do when you grow up? They just sat silent. What are you going to do? What profession? What skill are you going to, what are you going to do with your time? And one of the children raised a hand and said, we get a check from the government every month. We don't have to go do something. That absolutely happened. You see, no civilization can survive that kind of stuff for very long. Lack of wisdom, failure to be frugal, foolish use of resources. What about just wanting to goof off, play, have fun, physical stimulation? That's why some people are poor. I know a young man, I'm thinking of a young man, he has a major drinking problem. He will only work occasionally when he has to, and then he quickly drinks that up. He's now in dire physical condition with his liver and other health problems. And by the way, the government, see, steps in and pays for that. It's a sense in which I don't blame the poor boy. The environment, the social environment in which he was reared. But we have a lot of that going on in our country. Remember how Paul said to deal with that, talking to the Thessalonians? If a person won't work, they're not to eat. You better not give them anything to eat because they've chosen not to work. He's not talking about people that are physically unable to work. So, the love of pleasure, the Bible's filled with that. How about dishonesty and theft? Does that cause poverty? Proverbs says it does. God says it does. Covetousness, desire for someone else to supply their needs. What about fear? Remember the one talent man? He was afraid, so he just didn't do anything. And the master came back and said, you are one lazy person. Stingy, non-generous. Isn't that interesting? That's one of the reasons for poverty. You know, you think of the people that have, look at number five, that steal. They steal all the time. You would think they would get ahead, but they don't. They live hand to mouth and look for the next thievery to engage in. Notice all nine of these causes. Again, I'm overwhelmed by the fact that this comes from God. And I looked all through there to find, you know, more systemic reasons why people are poverty due to racism. And just a host of it. Mm-mm, not there. Not there. This is the stuff that just permeates the book. all the way through it. Notice then, God can't be blamed, the government can't be blamed, nor fellow man, because in this country, anyone can get ahead. Now, really, come on, they can. That's not just an overstatement or a dream, a wish. Anybody in this country can get ahead. Why do we know that? Because we've seen a whole bunch of people that had nothing, and they did it, and they surpassed all of us. You know a lot of people that have gone much further than you in income, accomplishments, and so forth? Why? Because they're in a capitalistic, free enterprise society where you are allowed to get ahead if you want to. But that doesn't mean it's not going to take a lot of hard work and sleepless hours. See, there's part of the problem. People don't want that. Then I combed through the law of Moses. How were the poor people dealt with under the law of Moses? There were four vulnerable elements stipulated over and over and over the law of Moses. The fatherless, the widow, the poor, and the immigrant. We don't have time to go into that. I don't know if we will in our last two sessions. But here are the 13 observations. Lend money to the poor without charging interest. Look at that. Give them money? No. You're damaging them. Don't do that. Lend it to them. Just don't gouge them. Don't charge them interest. Don't favor or disfavor the poor. Treat everybody the same. You know the Bible teaches that. God's impartial. He treats all of us the same. And yet our society and socialism is geared to do just the opposite. Don't make a profit on food sold to the poor. There should be, look at this. This occurs several times. There shouldn't be very many poor people in a society where the majority of the people follow God. So he's going to bless that country. Okay, if we're moving further and further that direction, then we're moving further and further away from God. Lend money to the poor, even if the year of release is near. Don't keep a poor man's collateral overnight. Pay him every day, at the end of every day, not weekly, monthly. Every seventh year, the poor were allowed to gather what grew naturally from a fallow field. Obviously, that wasn't intended to be welfare or a means of income. It was only every seventh year, and they had to gather it. Work. Landowners were to leave the corners of their fields and the leftovers for the poor to gather. They had to work. Poor and rich alike were to give the same amount of atonement offering. The poor must pay vows, though reduced to what he could afford. The poor may sell their self. How about that? You could sell yourself into slavery. But the biblical definition of slavery would be that you don't mistreat your fellow man. But you sell yourself in order to get the funds to do what has to be done, and then you work for that person to repay it. I guess we would call that more like an indentured servant. A lot of people came to America at the beginning that way. Every third year, in addition to the Levites, foreigners, orphans, and widows, the poor received benefits from the tithes. Summary, God's law under Moses required the poor to take far more responsibility for their circumstances than our government in America expects the so-called poor to take. Many Americans desperately need a reality check heralded from pulpits that no one owes any of us a living. We ought to be telling our kids that. Every time a child cops an attitude and acts like, I deserve this, we ought to tell them, nobody owes you anything. That's a healthy biblical concept. The only thing God owes us is hell. We earned it. We deserve it. Well, there's the grace and mercy of God. But to think that we're owed something, that's why it's wonderful to be permitted by God to live in a free country, and he expects us to take responsibility for ourselves. Both the founders and the Bible make clear, everyone can be equally free. Look at this. The founders believed that everybody was equal in freedom. Everyone's a human being made in the image of God, and therefore on equal level, equally free. But now what are you going to do with that? And they acknowledge the fact that not everyone has the same intellect, the same skills, the same education. So obviously we're not equal in this country in those areas. And naturally then you're not going to be equal in income. So any government that tries to equalize income is going awry, contradicting the will of God and the will of those who established our republic. You got to work for it. You got to go after it. All right, let's close with this. How many of you were alive in 1963 and old enough to remember it? Look at this. This is such a cool historical picture. Here's Kennedy. Here's his wife, Jacqueline. Here's the previous president, whose place he's taking, Eisenhower, commander of all Allied forces during World War II. And here's his wife. No, this is LBJ's wife, who's sitting right here. And here is Nixon. This is Mamie Eisenhower here, right? All right, you remember this statement that he made, which I don't believe would be permitted in the political arena today. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of mankind. See, even diverging political parties at that time were more in tune with each other concerning Christian, biblical, American values. There has been a lot of alteration. Here's a quick summary solution. We need to restore the family in this country as God intended. One man, one woman for life. No shacking up. No illegitimate children. Husband take responsibility for providing for his family. End unscriptural divorce. Discipline the children. Stop the immorality that's going on in our country. Reinstate the work ethic. Another way to say that, get married before having children. Finish your education. Get a job. That would solve so many of the problems that we in our country have. Look at how Psalm 128 words this. Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord and walks in his ways. When you eat the labor of your hands, you'll be happy. It'll be well with you. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine in the very heart of your house. Your children like olive plants all around your table. Thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. All right. I may have covered all of that on number one. I may spend a little bit of time on illegal immigration. I'd like to spend a session saying, what lies ahead for this country, do you think? I'm no prophet, but based on what the Bible teaches about past countries and the indicators that we're seeing in our country, where are we going with this? What's going to happen? What's going to be the outcome? Again, if you want to access information like this, there's material on the table and then a lot at our website. Thank you all for being, again, so attentive, and sorry to rush through this so quick, and hope it's helpful. I hope it's uplifting and encouraging to you. It may be kind of depressing to see how far we have strayed, veered from our founding principles and the way things were when you were a child. But God's still on the throne. And the remnant remains. Here's part of it right here tonight. Such a joy to be able to be with you. God bless you, and thank you for listening to me.